From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. Happy Thanksgiving. It's here and now. Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri is back in Beirut after he put his surprise resignation on hold yesterday. Hariri spoke at an Arab bankers' conference today and tried to reassure them that his country is stable. He stunned the entire region on November 4th when he announced his resignation in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. It was the same day that Saudi Arabia stunned the world when Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman detained 200 wealthy businessmen and members of the royal family in Riyadh's Ritz-Carlton Hotel. The government accused them of corruption, abuse of power, and money laundering. The BBC's Lise Doucette is just back from Riyadh, and Lise, you were the first journalist allowed into this gilded prison. What did you see?
First of all, you're taken aback by how sumptuous, how palatial the Ritz-Carlton is. No wonder it was the hotel of choice for President Donald Trump and his wife Melania when the American leader made his first foreign trip abroad. No wonder it was the hotel of choice for the world's top investors when they were in Saudi Arabia just weeks ago and were dazzled by the investment strategies of the 32-year-old Crown Prince. The question is, why was it the hotel of choice for a seismic shakedown of the Saudi leadership against more than 200 of the most powerful, the richest people in the kingdom? It's quite extraordinary.
Well, and about a dozen of these people are princes. Some of them are related to King Salman. Who is still there? Did you get a chance to speak to any of the prisoners? And do we know how they're being treated?
Well, it's very interesting. So, of course, we're going to a hotel, and it is still a hotel, a luxury hotel, and, of course, impeccably trained. So we turn up under police escort. We're met at the entrance by the staff of the Ritz-Carlton welcoming us as if it's, well,
wow.
Here's more guests checking in. But there was a less warm welcome from some senior members of the Anti-Corruption Commission. They called themselves the Special Committee. They said, you cannot film any faces and you cannot record any conversations. Before we went in, we asked to see some of the top people, but that never materialized. And I soon understood why. We went into this glorious lobby with glittering ceiling. And it's like a hotel lobby anywhere, I think, in many parts of it, certainly in Saudi Arabia, when it's 1 o'clock in the morning, people are still there drinking coffee. But the conversations are very hushed. And it turns out nearly all of the guests, certainly the 200 plus guests who are being held against their will, they're basically staying in their rooms. They don't want to run into other people who are sharing that same hotel. They don't want to run into family members or lawyers of other people. This is a damage limitation exercise. We were taken up to see one person. And again, it's really surreal. He's sitting there. He's dressed very casually. He's watching Premier League football.
Wow.
And I said, you know, so what? So, and I wasn't allowed. They said, don't ask about the case. And you feel a bit awkward because you know that there's senior Saudi officials with us. He's not a free man. I don't want him to say something that would in some way affect his case. So I just said, you know, how are you? And he said, well, basically, I'm spending time with my lawyer. He said, I haven't even asked my family members to come. Nobody of this lot has their mobile phone, but they have this hotline where they can call night and day to people to come and visit. He said, I am just focusing on my case. And I think that is what is the case for all of them. And quite strange, you know, you never lose a sense of what your dignity. As I'm going to leave, he goes, oh my goodness, I forgot. Can I offer you anything? I said, no, don't worry. I'm also in this 5-star hotel. I'll just get a coffee downstairs.
Wow.
And downstairs, we got a briefing. And basically, we were told, yes, these people were shocked and surprised when they were rounded up and brought in on the 4th of November around midnight. Some of them thought it was just some big spectacular show. They'd go home the next day. But when they realized that they were there to stay unless they faced the consequences, a lot of them were furious. These are powerful men who are used to running global empires, billions of dollars every day from their mobile phone. Everyone is at their beck and call. Suddenly, they're confined to this hotel and they have to sit down with some people who have been collecting evidence against them for the last 2 years. And they're told, this is the evidence. Talk to your lawyer. If you can prove that this is not ill-gotten gains, fine, we'll let you go. And 7 people have left. If not, if you recognize that this is ill-gotten gains through abuse of power or corruption, just give us back the money and you can leave the hotel. No more questions.
Well, let's talk about that. What is their fate? As you just said, the government seems to want to negotiate with these powerful, rich people, and they're willing to do it, it sounds like.
Well, negotiations may be too generous a term. They're basically presented with the evidence. They consult their lawyers. And in the case of seven people, I'm told, they looked at the bank statements, they looked at the figures, and they said, actually, that's not my money. That's not my bank account. That money went to my boss and not to me. And they actually have left the hotel. So you can get out without, you know, you can go past go without, what is it, the Monopoly game, without having to go to prison. I'm told 4% of those 201 people still left are still holding out and saying, I'm not guilty, I'm going to go to court. But the people from the Anti-Corruption Commission I spoke to said they thought that more and more would just want to avoid a high-profile trial. But it is going to take some time. But the longer this goes on, of course, the more questions are going to be asked and the more sensitive it's going to be, because there are many who say this is not about a corruption. This is about a power grab by the power of already powerful Crown Prince. But it must be said that outside that gilded prison, almost every young Saudi and even not young Saudis that I spoke to, they all welcomed this crackdown on corruption. It's like one man who's a very prominent real estate dealer said to me, listen, it's like you lost your watch and then you found it. You think, wow, I'm so glad I got my watch back.
That's the BBC's Lise Doucette, just back from the gilded prison, the Ritz, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Lise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And on this Thanksgiving, let's hear a story of gratitude and the power of community. Gardner Waldeyer produces videos for YouTube, and he's grateful for his friends and his neighbors. They're helping him raise the frame of a house he's building out of the trees on his property in Maine. John Kalish reports.
Gardner Waldeyer lives in Waterford, Maine. 1,000 subscribers to his YouTube channel know him as Bus Huxley. The lanky 35-year-old makes his living as a cook, builder, and doer of odd jobs. He's done 35 episodes so far in a series titled A House from Trees, which chronicles him harvesting the forest on his property and building a timber frame house.
So I'm going to try to get this enormous log right here. I'm going to try to get that onto the trailer. We'll see if that works.
In October, Waldeyer put the word out that he'd be raising the frame of the house in early November. Family, friends, and neighbors gathered in the frigid Saturday morning air near a table laid out with hot coffee and homemade scones baked by Waldeyer's partner, Sarah. Some drove several hours to help out. Luke Stone runs a wedding catering company in Vermont. He came to cook for the volunteers.
When I pulled in, I figured there'd be four people here trying to put something together, and I may even be needed to help, but I show up and there's 30 cars here.
Ethan Hippel drove 90 minutes from Portland with his wife Sarah and their two teenagers. Hippel and Waldeyer once worked together at a state park in New Hampshire.
Biggest fans. I'd say we're probably the biggest fans.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen every video multiple times.
In addition to his series, A House from Trees, Waldeyer's YouTube channel features videos on cooking, animals, and auto mechanics. Paul Houseman lives in the nearby town of Albany, Maine. Houseman traded Waldeyer some fabric that prevents water from seeping up in a driveway for a cutting board made of locust wood featured in one of Waldeyer's videos.
He's a Renaissance man, as they say. Gardner's kind of a local legend around here. So,
what this Renaissance man was up to on this particular day amounted to solving a puzzle involving four wooden structures that weighed 2,000 pounds each. A crane used thick nylon bands to pull the U-shaped pieces known as bents upright as four men screwed supports into them. The timbers used for the frame were heavy, and each was 8 inches by 8 inches. Waldeyer managed to move them around on sawhorses by himself as he cut tendons. But on the day the frame was raised, he let Matt Burke run the show. Every Friday, Burke has his morning coffee while watching the latest Bus Huxley video. Burke built dozens of timber frame homes with his father.
My dad used to raise them without a crane at all. It would go up by manpower and pike poles and block and tackle if you could find something to hook it to. So we'd have raisings like this.
Raisings like this because there were so many people helping, even with the crane doing much of the heavy lifting.
If it were at anybody else's location, Gardner would be one of the first guys to show up.
That's neighbor Jeff Winslow.
It was kind of like a old-fashioned barn raising, a community event. You don't see that just everywhere today.
At the end of the day, the volunteers gathered around a bonfire and feasted on spare ribs cooked by the wedding caterer, Luke Stone. Standing in the glow, Waldeyer was clearly pleased with the two-story house frame awaiting walls, floors, and a roof.
Here it is. It's a big square pile of timber now, and it's up high. Oh, my goodness. It's something.
Gardener Waldeyer hopes to have a roof on his house before December rolls around. He expects he'll produce videos on this house built from trees for another couple of years. For Here and Now, I'm John Kalish in Waterford, Maine.
Don't let him bring it down, now. Bring it down. Don't let him bring it down.
That's banjo duo Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn. The song is off their latest album, Echo in the Valley, which tops Billboard's Bluegrass Albums chart this week. Bela and Abigail are married. They're considered the best banjo players in the world, and it was my pleasure to have them both in the studio. Now, I understand for this album, you came to it with a couple of rules, and one of them was any sound on the album had to come straight from U2 and only U2. Is that right?
That is right.
And why?
Sometimes you go to see a show, and when you pick up the music, it's like, oh, whoa, this is really different music than what I heard on stage. Mm-hmm. And I think Bale and I really love the aesthetic of sounding like us everywhere all the time. And there's also a point of pride, which that there really aren't banjo duos out there. Mm. And so we wanted to share with people the glory of the sound of the banjo, at least from our perspective. We wanted to be able to share that with people and tell them you don't need more than banjos.
Well, that's right. One of the other rules, which is only banjos.
Right. And the thing about banjos is a lot of times you hear it and you go, wow, can one person possibly be doing that? And I don't mean that in some like ego-y way. I mean, that's the nature of banjo. It's a lot of repeated notes. And a lot of times you have multiple voices happening inside. With two banjos, we can make a lot of sound and there would be the temptation to listen to it and go, oh, there's probably some overdubs. Huh. So we like the idea of saying, no, this is just what two banjos can sound like.
Do you think, though, that those rules actually work? Do they help you make a better album?
Limitations are a godsend. Otherwise, you'd just be floating in the sea of possibility. Hmm.
Yeah, I think finding some limitations is how you define art.
You know, it's also a big piece of finding your voice. At least this has been my experience. There was a while in my career where I felt frustrated by my limitations, the things I'm not good at as an artist. When I started getting over that and recognizing the things that I embody so well or that I channel so well, I started understanding my own voice.
But I think that your fans and anyone who would just hear you play would say, Abigail Washburn, what kind of limitations do you have?
I speak Chinese. I love singing in Chinese. I play the banjo. I play clawhammer banjo only. I play a certain style of clawhammer banjo. I sing in a very certain kind of way, a voice that doesn't do everything. So to me, it's very clear.
It's also a way that we're different in that I've tried really hard to do everything that you can do with three-finger style, from traditional to ethnic music and from jazz to classical, and that's part of my identity. But Abigail has a very clear identity. Hers is, I do this, and I focus in on this, and that's me. And that's, in a way, that defines the duo in a lot of ways. I find the things that I can do that fit into that.
I do want to add that I think there's a lot of clarity about who you are as an artist, even though you can do so many things. I would define you as a musician that's trying to show the world and yourself that anything is possible on the banjo.
Does this mean I have to put the garbage out?
Yes, honey. Definitely.
Two married musicians. Let's hear some of the music. How about Over the Divide?
All right. Here we go.
You got a troubled mind. Isn't it a shame, dear? Wish it wasn't true. Wishing there was something that we all could do. Walking through the deserts, sailing over the seas. Sister, brother, refugees. Yeah, 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 oh. Yeah, 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 oh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, that's Over the Divide. And we heard that there's a story to this one.
Yeah, it actually was inspired by the story of a Austrian Jewish sheep herder.
Yodeling
sheep herder.
Uh-huh.
This was at the height of when we were hearing about the Syrian refugee crisis in the news. And we woke up one morning and saw a link to an article about this guy named Hans Brewer. His family was ferried through the night to safety and friends during the Holocaust. And so he got in his minivan and he drove down the unmarked roads that only sheep herders know over the Austro-Hungarian border to the other side and found Syrian families who had walked that far from Syria through the fields. Mm. And he picked them up in his minivan and he took them back over the border undetected to safe places in Austria.
While yodeling.
And the Syrians in the back of his minivan were just having a laugh.
We had already had this instrumental we were playing at soundcheck every day, and I had this chorus in my mind, isn't it a shame, dear, wish it wasn't true, wishing there was something that we all could do about how we all feel about all the stuff that's coming at us. But we don't do anything a lot of the time.
Or we don't know what to do.
Or we don't know what to do. Well, it was cool to find somebody who knew what to do.
I'm watching you tell that story, and I can see your body language. You're kind of turned in towards each other. Your husband and wife, I'm sure you get asked this question all the time. But are you better musicians because you live together and you're in sync? Or does that sometimes just even make it harder because, you know, someone made a mess on the bus that day or something?
That is annoying when that happens.
No comment. Why is everyone looking at me?
No, I was trying not to do that.
No, I think on the first record, honestly, we made the record right after our boy Juno was born. And so we really had to work with things we already had. We weren't writing a lot of music. But on this new album, now he's 3 years old and three and a half by the time we started working on it. And we really tried to write words together. And it was a really different experience because we didn't always agree about it. It was particularly tough because when someone you love doesn't like your idea, it hurts, and you have to kind of get past that to where the best solution is. But gradually, as we started to find, like, okay, we finally finished a version of this song, Harlan, that we both loved the lyric we came up with, and it was like, hey, we got one, and then we got another one, and then pretty soon we had four of them. It was like, wow, we got four songs that we both really agree, and we had to discard some of the ideas that each of us were very attached to and find the middle ground between us, and that's what relationships are all about.
Well, let's hear what that sounds like. You mentioned Harlan. Mm-hmm. I think the official title is Take Me to Harlan.
Such a long way. There's an echo in the valley. I can hear it calling back to me. My heart is tied to you, love.
That was amazing. I mean, you are both singing and dancing in that song, Abigail.
It's true. It's a special challenge we decided to take on for this record. In fact, that's the way we decide to do a lot of songs. There's some goal,
a challenge,
something you want to rise to that you've never risen to musically before. And in this one, it was definitely doing Appalachian clogging moves, very simple moves that I know, but enough to get into trouble and try to do foot percussion to a song.
Well, I was wondering if you could do me a favor, because my favorite song of yours came off your last album that you did together, your version of Railroad. I was hoping you could play it for us today.
Absolutely.
One, two, three, four. I've been working on the railroad all my little long days. I've been working on the railroad just to pass the time away. Can't you hear the whistle blowing? Rise up so early in the morning. Can't you hear the captain shout, Dinah, won't you blow your horn? Dinah, won't you blow your horn? blow, Dinah, won't you blow, Dinah, won't you blow your horn? Viva Fidelio, strumming on the open Joe.
I love that song, and the reason that I do is because it is such a traditional song, and yet whatever you're doing there sounds so incredibly fresh. How is it that you innovate in bluegrass like that?
It's an incredibly organic process sometimes. My grandma sang it to my mom when she was going to bed, and my mom sang it to me when I was going to bed, but in the major version, which sounds a bit different from the one we do.
Right. Abby was teaching Juno how to bang on the table when he was maybe 1.5, and she was singing along.
I think he was only like 9 months or something.
Okay, he was 9 months.
Your son, right?
And yeah. But I called home from out on tour, and she said, hey, well, check this out. And she started singing I've Been Working on the Railroad in a minor key while they were banging. And I thought, wow, that's awesome. He's banging on the table. But I've never heard that song done that way before. Huh. I said, honey, we should do something with that. That's a really special thing.
Interesting. It's almost like, you know, music changes as you pass it down through the generation. I mean, it was happening organically there with your child.
That's the folk process.
Yeah. Huh.
And I would argue that if you don't change it, maybe you're not serving the song that well. If you just do it as a museum version of what it's always been, maybe you're not giving it everything you could give it.
That's Bela Fleck and Abigail Washburn joining us in the studios and playing some fantastic music. Thank you so much for coming in. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having us, and happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Gobble, gobble.
Gobble, gobble. If you have a little extra time today, you can watch a video that we've produced of Bela and Abigail perform Take Me to Harlan. It's in our studios. You can find it at hereandnow.org. Watching football on Thanksgiving Day used to be special, but these days there's a Thursday game every week of the season. And some of the players aren't happy about it. Here's Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger talking to 93.7 The Fan in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's miserable. It's terrible. They need to get rid of this game, I think. Just play on Mondays and Sundays. You know, it's so tough on guys. You're beat up. You're banged up.
Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, what's Roethlisberger's issue with these games on Thursdays?
Well, first of all, let's just establish the fact that Ben Roethlisberger has been oddly complainy for him. He's having a good season, but at one point he surmised the game may have passed him by. But yes, and it's not just Ben Roethlisberger when it comes to Thursday night football. The league instituted regular Thursday night football to get more money, to get more television advertisers. And sometimes when players get hurt, they will point to the fact that they don't have enough time to recuperate. So when Richard Sherman, the defensive back on the Seahawks, was lost on a Thursday night injury, this kind of came to the fore. And he and his teammate, Doug Baldwin, said, this is ridiculous. This is unconscionable. But the thing is, if you do the numbers, if you run the statistics on injury rates of Thursday games against all the other games the NFL plays, there is really no difference. But football is such a brutal sport. I do have sympathy. These guys know how their bodies feel and they know how they ache, and it hurts more to play Thursday night football. But I guess we could put that aside a little bit because Thanksgiving is its own thing and the games will be definitely going on today.
Right. No one's arguing that the Thanksgiving game should go away. They are a tradition in the NFL and for American football fans all over the country. But look, Mike, the players' union agreed to this. So what's the deal with that? I mean, this is not a surprise to anybody.
The players make a lot of money on Thursday night football. They get a large percentage of the contract that the networks pay to televise these games. But there'll be another collective bargaining agreement, and they'll decide if they want to play Thursday football. Who knows how salient the issue will be the next time it comes up for a vote.
Well, another issue the NFL is dealing with, of course, this idea of kneeling for the national anthem. The NFL, the owners, are floating a plan now to keep players in the locker room for the anthem next season if the players continue to protest by kneeling this year. Is that going to do anything for this controversy, Mike?
Here is my idea of what the NFL owners should do. And some of them do have a direct line and they could do this. They should ask Donald Trump, what will stop you tweeting about it? Because
right.
I can just imagine if they go into the locker room and he needs to, you know, boost his ratings among certain precincts, he will say, it is a shame that the NFL players aren't coming out and standing. And then the issue doesn't go away. So they really have a constituency of one on this issue, and he's driving the national conversation. And I do believe that there definitely are people who are put off by the players kneeling. And I do not put it out of the realm of possibility that this has hurt ratings a bit on the margins, and that's what the owners care about. But there are so many other factors that this gets pointed to, and maybe the owners are scrambling about trying to overcorrect a phenomenon that is actually not at the core of their problem.
And by the way, Donald Trump this week has already tweeted that staying in the locker room is almost as bad as kneeling. So you're not going to make anyone happy. That's Mike Pesca here in Now's sports analyst. Thanks very much, Mike.
You're welcome.
For those of you stuck on a plane at some point this week, you might have asked yourself one of the most pressing questions of our era. Why are these seats so small? And look, it's not your imagination. American Airlines, for example, announced this fall that it's adding as many as 12 more seats to their planes with one aisle, a move that could generate $500 million more dollars in revenue in the next 4 years. For more, we're joined by Seth Kaplan, managing partner of Airline Weekly. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Peter.
These airline seats, they are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. What's going on?
They are. Look, airlines can do the math. They know that if they can put more seats onto the same airplane, their costs are kind of the same to a large degree, no matter how many seats they have. They're paying the same two pilots, a lot of the same airport costs and so forth, but they get to divide those costs among more seats. So they like putting more seats onto airplanes. The good news for passengers is that some of the room that they're taking away isn't from us in the form of legroom. Airlines realize, hey, they're not making as many hot meals anymore. They don't need that big kitchen in the galley. So some of it, they're just, shrinking the galley and that sort of thing. But no question, there is, on average, less legroom than there used to be.
Well, even a seat that is an inch smaller can make a big difference if you have to sit in that plane for a 5-hour flight.
It can. And one thing airlines have done is found some of that room by actually shrinking the seat backs. So the seats aren't as cushiony. Maybe that's not as comfortable in some ways. But, they can take away an inch more or less now without taking that away from the passenger. But some of them have been adding so many seats that even though the seat backs are thinner than they used to be, that does result still in less legroom. And yeah, especially if you're tall, that can make a big difference on a really long trip.
Now, when airlines started taking frills away from passengers, when they took meals away, when you had to start to pay for bags and that sort of thing, it was all because the airlines at the time were trying to figure out how to recover after the recession. But airline profits have been pretty good lately. Why are they still doing this?
Well, they're worried that the good times might not last forever. And by the way, we're talked about legroom. They're taking away elbow room too in some cases, squeezing 10 seats across rather than 9. Ugh. Some airlines on those big planes that you fly to places like Europe and Asia. Profits were down in 2016 compared to 2015. And it looks like they'll be down again this year. And so, look, airlines on one hand say, look, we've reformed the business. It's never going to be as bad as a decade ago when airlines were going bankrupt and laying off lots of workers. But on the other hand, they, from their perspective, feel like they can't take anything for granted. And if they can figure out a way to make a few more dollars on a flight, they're going to do that.
And all of this is happening in coach. The seats are getting smaller, as in business class and first class. It's getting more and more luxurious. You're getting seats that recline into full beds. I mean, what about that? It seems unfair.
Kind of a dichotomy. Although, on the other hand, whereas it kind of seemed a few years ago like there was this inexorable race to the bottom. They were just taking away. So on one hand, they've taken away some room. On the other hand, they've actually restored some things in the past few years now that they are making so much money. If you look at Delta, American, and United, they had all taken away, meals on every domestic flight. And they weren't serving free beer and wine and economy on flights to Europe and all that sort of thing. Now, they've put some of that back on. They're all serving some snacks. They're serving that beer and wine again on long-haul flights. The in-flight entertainment on a couple of those airlines anyway, all of it's free again, including the premium meals. So it's kind of more of a mixed picture now than maybe how it looked a couple of years ago, even though very clearly it's never going to be like the good old days with that hot meal on a 2-hour flight in economy. That's very clearly gone.
Is there a point when airlines have to stop cramming more people onto planes?
Yeah, and the regulations are already there. There is, for every kind of aircraft, a maximum number of seats that you're allowed to put onto the airplane. So you can't blame people for saying, you know, when's it going to end? But the answer is that on a few airlines, at least, it can't go any further because they're not allowed to. So when you think about those what are called ultra-low-cost airlines like Spirit, Frontier, and Allegiant, all of those airlines are already just about at the maximum number of seats that you're allowed to put on an airplane in America. It has to do, by the way, not with legroom per se, but with how fast you can evacuate an airplane. Mm. It has to do with those emergency exits and how many people you can get off. And because they're already at that limit, those airlines at least can't add any more seats.
Okay, let's switch gears for just a minute. You cover the entire airline industry, and obviously if folks are traveling for Thanksgiving, they've got those tickets in the books. But what about later in the year, New Year's, Christmas, that sort of thing? Is there still a way to get a good deal?
The good news is, yeah, that it's sort of a myth that, you know, the farther in advance you buy tickets, the less you pay. The truth is that although, hey, look, if you wait until the very last minute, you're going to pay a lot. The opposite of that is not necessarily true. It's not the very early bird who gets the cheapest airline ticket. On average, between about a month and 2 months before you travel is when fares are the cheapest. And yeah, that tends to be true even with holiday travel. So there are some relatively decent deals out there for late December, early January travel, even though, hey, it's a holiday period. Average fares then are always going to be higher, yeah, regardless of when you buy than other times of the year.
All right. Seth Kaplan, managing partner of Airline Weekly. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, yesterday we heard about the advances that researchers are making against pancreatic cancer. Today, a development in the fight against a common blood cancer, B-cell lymphoma. It develops in the lymph nodes. Older adults and people with weakened immune systems are most vulnerable. Now the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved a promising new treatment. It's called Yescarta, and it's part of a new approach to treating blood cancers by re-engineering the immune system. A handful of cancer centers across the country now offer it, including the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Karen Weintraub from WBUR reports.
Yeah, no, we're busy. It's good, yeah.
Judith Wilkins normally has too much energy to stay still. At 59, with hair tinted a fun mermaid green, she's always cutting, combing, blowing, or fussing at the hair salon she owns in Woburn, Massachusetts. But last year, after 18 months of chemotherapy to treat her B-cell lymphoma, the cancer was winning. Running through all the typical life-saving options left Wilkins exhausted. Then, her oncologist got her one of the last slots in a clinical trial for an emerging therapy called CAR-T.
But I remember saying to her, no, I'm not doing this. I said, it's a trial, I'm not going to do it. And she looked right at me and she said, yeah, we are going to do this. It's going to be okay.
This meant sending Wilkins' blood to a lab in California. There, technicians took out immune cells called T cells and re-engineered them so they'd go after the cancerous cells that were making her sick.
The best way to describe it, it's like a Pac-Man in my body. The cells just cruise through your blood and identifies the bad B cell and just eats it.
And the Pac-Man cells don't stop there. Glenn Drainoff is global head of immuno-oncology at the Novartis Institutes for Biomedical Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
They become part of the immune memory system so that they can persist for long periods of time and prevent a recurrence of the cancer.
In August of last year, the altered T cells were put back into Wilkins' body. Within a few hours, she felt horrible. Her immune system went into overdrive, as often happens with CAR-T therapy. It felt like a really bad case of the flu. Wilkins spent 9 days in the hospital and the rest of August sleeping. But a scan at the end of the month couldn't find any cancer in her body. She was back at her job cutting hair again just after Labor Day. And, more than a year later, her scans are still clean.
I am the poster child for CAR-T cell therapy. What has happened with my body? It's incredible. It really is.
CAR-T doesn't help every cancer patient as much as it's helped Wilkins. For her type of cancer, about 30% get results like she did, with another 20 to 50% getting a much shorter extension on life. Dr. Karen Jacobson is Judith Wilkins' oncologist at Dana-Farber.
When they leave the hospital, walking out of here, eating, you know, going back to their families, making new memories, and going back to work, you know, within a couple of short weeks, it gives you chills.
Right now, CAR-T therapy is approved for just two types of blood cancer, B-cell lymphoma and one rare form of childhood leukemia. And treatment comes with a staggering cost. The newly approved Yescarta is priced at $373,000 for a one-time infusion of engineered T-cells. Another treatment, Kymriah from Novartis, costs $475,000. The companies have picked up the cost as part of the clinical trials, but with FDA approval, more patients will have access to the therapy, and the cost will shift to patients and their insurance companies. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Weintraub.
All across America, a tremendous amount of butter will be eaten today. You should see the sticks stacked up in my refrigerator that are going into like half a dozen pies. But you know, butter has a history that goes back thousands of years. Food writer Elaine Khosrova traveled the world researching her book, Butter, A Rich History. I spoke with Elaine last year when it was first published, and I asked how she came to write an entire book about butter.
Yeah, that's a good question, considering for most of my life and my career as a food writer, I took butter completely for granted. Of course, I had it in my refrigerator, and I cooked with it, and I baked with it, but I really never gave it much attention. Then one day, I had to actually do a butter tasting with about 12 different butters, and I remember sitting down to this table of tastings and being astonished by the differences in color, in texture, in flavor, aroma. I was really surprised, and I had no way of accounting for why they were so different. I mean, I knew that butter was made from taking cream and churning it. So essentially, you had one ingredient, and yet you had all this variation. So I was really surprised and intrigued.
So it's not as mundane as we think it is. And I, reading your book, I was fascinated by this idea that I think you seem to be in awe of as well, that butter comes from a cow, which has this lazy life sort of eating grass and other plants that are not exactly teeming with fat. And yet cows produce this rich, fatty milk that yields the cream, which eventually becomes butter. It's almost magic.
Yeah, I talk about this Rumpelstiltskin kind of effect inside cows. But I have to say, Peter, it's also in other ruminants, there are many other animals that can give us milk fat that we can make butter from. A water buffalo, the yak, goat, sheep, reindeer. You can actually have reindeer butter. I mean, it's very uncommon, but the Laplanders back in the 19th century used to make reindeer butter simply by putting it a little bit of their milk in a bowl, and the women would whisk it with their bare hands because, of course, it's very cold there.
And butter is ancient. I mean, that kind of proves the point that butter goes way back, all the way to very early humans. What do we know about its history?
It's likely that, similar to domestication of animals, you know, it happened in different places at different times. It's not like it happened in one place and then spread out from there. But we know that, for instance, the ancient Sumerians who lived 2500 B.C., they were making butter. They have temple carvings showing churning and showing the cows. So that's thousands of years ago. It has a very long history.
And it was probably accidental the way it was discovered.
Most likely. The theory is that the milk ended up in a container, probably an animal skin, because back in the day, that's how people transported milk. And it got bumped on, you know, some road along the way, some traveling that the shepherd was doing. Mm-hmm. And through that, it was essentially churned, because agitation is what you need to make butter. We call it churning, but any kind of agitation will make butter.
So a happy surprise. Do you think it tastes today much the way it did so many centuries ago?
No, I doubt that it does. I think it was a much more fermented product then, without sanitation, without refrigeration. Everything was raw, for instance, and so the flavors of, you know, lactic bacteria would develop quickly, especially in those temperatures. So I think it was a much more funky product back in the day.
Huh. Well, it's also tied up in religion. It's mentioned in the book of Genesis. Tibetan monks are known for these sacred sculptures that they make with butter. You mentioned that there have been carvings of it found in ancient temples. What is the link between butter and divinity?
What we can surmise is that butter was really a sort of magical food. It was valuable and they used it every day, but they really never understood how it was created. Why is it that milk that's liquid and white can suddenly yield these, you know, delicious, rich, golden pieces of fat? You know, how could that happen? It's a little bit like pearls and oysters or rainbows happening. You know, there's no real explanation until you can tease the science apart. So it had this quality that was somewhat magical, and it was also very valuable. So I think it was that combination that gave butter its kind of metaphysical role.
Huh. And you, your favorite is water buffalo butter from India.
Oh, I don't want to say favorite,
okay,
actually.
Okay, but I mean, high on the list.
High on the list was this one particular water buffalo butter that I had in India in a small, tiny village made by a woman who took the whole milk and fermented it, made it like a rich, delicious yogurt, and then she churned that, and it was outstanding. But I love French butter. There's some great American butters. It's such a good time to be a butter lover. There's so many good choices out there.
Elaine Kostrova's book is Butter, A Rich History. And Elaine, the last quarter of your book is full of recipes that celebrate butter. Why don't you just give us your favorite, and we'll link to it at hereandnow.org.
Well, I love pie, and I love a good, tender, buttery crust. Yeah, I would put that up there. But there's some really nice sort of comfort food recipes, great pound cake, things like that. Classic butter things.
Great. Elaine, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, I love pie, too. I spoke with Elaine last November. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.